It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, July 28th. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Today, violent crime is rising in Minneapolis. We hear from Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges, who talks about dealing with the crime. Twin Cities Muslims defy typical stereotypes, and a biker tries to pedal all of the continents. First, the Pipestone County Sheriff says a fixed-wing airplane crashed in a cornfield last night, killing the pilot and two passengers. Authorities say the crash occurred near Holland, and investigators from the FAA are on the scene. That crash occurred about 3 hours after a plane went down in a field southwest of Amory, Wisconsin. Four people were killed in that crash. State officials today are set to announce taxpayers will get a major payment from managed care organizations that handle Medicaid and Minnesota Care contracts. Mark Zedeklik reports.
People with knowledge of the 2014 state contracts tell NPR News that the health insurance companies and county managed care organizations are returning more than $100 million to taxpayers. Under the contract between the plans and the state, taxpayers would get money back if Minnesota Care and Medicaid customers were healthier than expected. That's what happened in 2014. If people had been sicker than expected, taxpayers would have been on the hook to the insurance companies for more money as part of the shared risk agreement. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Two appeals court judges and the Minneapolis city attorney are on the short list to replace Alan Page on the Minnesota Supreme Court. Tim Nelson has more.
The state's Commission on Judicial Selection has recommended three candidates to replace the outgoing Supreme Court justice. They include Court of Appeals Judge Margaret Chudich, a former assistant U.S. attorney and attorney general. Her fellow judge Natalie Hudson is also a former assistant attorney general and a former city attorney for St. Paul. She was shortlisted for the Supreme Court in 2013 as well. The third candidate is Susan Siegel, Minneapolis city attorney and former assistant Hennepin County attorney. She's also the spouse of State Budget Commissioner Myron Franz. Governor Mark Dayton will be interviewing them in the next few weeks and is expected to name a replacement to take over when Page retires at the end of August. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A report of a suspicious package shut down streets near the state capitol for 2 hours yesterday. Peter Cox has more.
A construction worker at the state capitol spotted suspicious packages in a third-floor stairwell in the middle of the afternoon. The area was locked down and workers evacuated. The St. Paul Fire Department arrived with a hazmat team. A few blocks of Cedar Street next to the Capitol were shut down. But the packages turned out to be paper products and brick mortar. The state capitol is closed to visitors while it undergoes a restoration project that will cost around $300 million. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A University of Minnesota study published yesterday says fertilizer from crops could be contributing to global warming more than previously believed. Here's Elizabeth Dunbar.
The study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says estimates for nitrous oxide for the central U.S. could be too low by as much as 40%. The study looked at nitrous oxide emissions from Minnesota rivers that receive agricultural runoff. The results suggest the emissions are 9 times greater than estimates used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. University researcher Peter Turner, one of the study's authors, says the findings are important because nitrous oxide is a potent greenhouse gas.
It is about 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide and 12 times more potent than methane in terms of its global warming potential.
Turner says the new measurements will help inform strategies for reducing the emissions. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis police are grappling with another spike in violence. Three men are dead and more were wounded from gunfire, which rang out in separate incidents in Minneapolis over the weekend and yesterday. The latest deaths bring the total number of homicides to 29, up from 19 at this time last year in Minneapolis. The violence erupted despite efforts by the police department to move more officers to trouble spots. Brant Williams reports.
Let us bow our head, please.
Pastor Harding Smith's bald brown head glistens with sweat under the July sun and humidity. He and several other members of the group Minnesota Acts Now hold a vigil on the corner of Chicago and Franklin Avenues, not far from where two men were shot and killed this weekend.
Father God, we come before you today, Lord Jesus, to bring peace in our cities.
Smith and members of his group have held similar vigils near where people were killed or wounded. He says familiar factors are at work in this year's spike in violence. Smith says too many people feel they have no other choice but to use lethal violence to solve their disputes. He says those acts of violence lead to vengeance. Smith made an appeal to the public to break the cycle.
If you are out there, you have lost a loved one due to gun violence, please, we are begging you, do not take the law into your own hands. Please, let the police do their work, let the community do their work, and believe in God that justice will be done.
Police say another man was killed early Monday morning in North Minneapolis after a dispute between two groups of people turned deadly. They say the man's body was found in the street near the intersection of 34th and Morgan Avenues. Another person was treated for non-life-threatening injuries. And there were two other non-fatal shootings reported early Saturday in Dinkytown and the Warehouse District. In the latter case, police say an officer shot an armed suspect. The shootings come at a time when the department has already taken steps to tamp down on another rise in violence. Earlier this month, police responded to a pair of Northside killings by adding 8 more police officers. Police Union President Lieutenant Bob Kroll says more officers on the street will make the city safer, but he says temporary redeployments are not the answer.
Because by doing that, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Kroll says there aren't enough officers on the street right now to properly respond to the level of crime, so it's not sustainable to move officers from one precinct to the other. He says the department is well short of the 860 sworn officers the city is authorized to hire. Kroll says even that amount isn't enough to allow the department to recreate some of the now defunct specialty enforcement teams like the traffic and SWAT units.
Our department should have upwards of 900. In my career, I've seen it go from as low as 760 to as high as 940. If you've got over 900 officers, that's when you can do those other types of things.
Police officials say the department has experienced a few more retirements this year than they expected. However, they say another 30 or more officers are scheduled to hit the streets by the end of this year. Mayor Betsy Hodges says the city is hiring as quickly as it can, but she says police leaders are doing a good job placing officers where they're needed.
It's not how many of them there are, it's what are they doing. And they're having conversations, they're doing personal follow-ups when incidents happen or we hear shots fired. They're finding out from people what their experience is, getting as much information as they can.
Hodges says police and city leaders are doing everything they can to reduce and prevent future outbursts of violence. And she says despite the latest uptick, Minneapolis is still a safe city. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
We heard from Mayor Betsy Hodges in Brant's piece talking about a spike in violence in her city. Tom Cran talked with the mayor last night on All Things Considered.
Do you see anything behind what seems like a rise in these shootings in the city? Anything in common or tying them together?
You know, we've been doing our best to analyze that data. I know as I talk to colleagues around the country, this is something that's happening nationwide. But when it's happening in your neighborhood, you don't care that it's happening in Pittsburgh or that it's happening in New Orleans. But we're looking at seeing what we can find out about how these things are happening and what we can do about it.
Now, earlier this month, you actually asked for an increase in additional officers on the north side, 8 additional officers. Are you asking the police department to do anything more in response now since then?
Well, one of the benefits of having done the high-tech work we've been doing over the years, we've identified where the hot spots are. They are the spots that are hot this summer. So we know where the resources are needed most. You can put 8 officers out there, and we are putting our crime prevention specialists are out there, folks in the probation, our joint enforcement teams, gang interdiction teams, Safe Streets Task Force. I could go on. We have folks, but it's not how many of them there are, it's what are they doing. And they're having conversations, they're doing personal follow-ups when incidents happen or we hear shots fired. They're finding out from people what their experience is, getting as much information as they can. You know, we through our high tech, we know where the hot spots are, but we need high touch to make sure that we're having the conversations and building the relationships we need so that long-term we can find out what's happening and short-term we can find out what has just happened.
About the number of police officers. First, are you satisfied with the Minneapolis Police Department's response here? And can you speak to the fact that the force is at about, 820 officers when budgetarily it's authorized? My understanding is for about 860.
Yes, we have a budget authorization for 860 sworn personnel. We are hiring as quickly as we can, so if anybody in the sound of my voice is interested in being a police officer, we're interested in talking to you. But yes, I think the police department is doing what we would want the police department to do. You know, the analysis on what's happening, as well as the investigation, but also making sure that people are out there having the conversations needed, building those personal relationships to get the information that we need. I mean, for the community to know, look, we know that this is happening. We know that this is scary for folks, and we are on it, and we are doing the work needed to do our best to prevent it from happening, but also to make sure that we know what has happened already.
Could you have hired more officers earlier on so they would be trained and up to speed now for the summer?
We have been working on that for quite some time. We have a workforce plan, you know, that has to account for officers retiring as well as wanting to get up to our authorized strength. So like I said, for quite some time, we have been hiring as much and as quickly as we can. I put a lot more money in the budget for 2015 for additional community service officers classes, as well as, you know, more traditional hiring. We're doing it as fast as we can. Yeah.
Now, our reporter, Brant Williams, spoke with the president of the Police Federation, Lieutenant Bob Kroll, who thinks that actually he blames some of this on the reduced number of officers. And he thinks that ideal strength of the Minneapolis police force should be around 900 or more. Should that be the goal?
You know, certainly to do community policing, we want to make sure we have enough folks out on the street that they have the time they need at each call, that they don't have to run from call to call to call. But right now, we have the authorized folks out on the street. There may be some more overtime associated with that until we hire more folks. But, you know, we have the folks out there. And at this point, it's not the question of numbers necessarily, as it is what are those folks doing. And, you know, we have increased the strength out there between our folks, the joint enforcement team, including the sheriffs, Metro Transit, State Patrol, the parks. Our school resource officers are out there on bikes talking with people all during the summer. You know, we have increasing investigators on our ballistics, community response team. We have a lot of folks and a lot of resources who are on the case, and part of what they're doing is investigation, but part of what they're doing, and this is important, is talking with folks in the community and building those relationships.
Now, you say it's part of a national problem. It's been a summer of increased violence in cities around the country, and Chicago, notably, has been having a tough summer. I saw a report on the situation there recently on PBS, on the NewsHour, and their police superintendent said basically it's a simple formula. New York State did it. Stiffen the gun laws and lighten up on the narcotics penalties. And he said, you'll see gun seizures go down. You'll see murders go down at the same time. Would that work in Minneapolis? And can you see a pathway to that?
Look, one of the things that I always say is if there wasn't a gun, there wouldn't have been a shooting. If there wasn't a gun, there wouldn't have been a shooting. If there wasn't an illegal gun, in many cases, there wouldn't have been a shooting. So absolutely, you know, at the heart of this, the question that we have to ask ourselves is how is it that we are going to have rational gun laws in this country and in this state? Because right now we don't have them. Right now we don't have them. I am a great admirer of the Constitution and the Second Amendment. I don't want to infringe on anybody's rights in that way. But there's a limit. You know, we're the only country in the world that has firearms in its founding document. And it's confusing to people from around the world when people are killing each other and babies are killing each other and people are killing our babies with guns, with illegal guns, why it is we can't do something about that and why it is we can't get a hold of that. If there hadn't been a gun, there wouldn't have been a shooting.
As mayor, do you work with mayors of other cities in trying to combat this? And is there anything being done out there that you see working?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have a long-term strategy. It is a priority of me and my administration that our neighbors and our kids in 5 to 10 years, they're not going to be going through what our neighbors and our kids are going through right now. And so we have partnerships at the national level. You know, we have a burn grant to say, okay, we have all this data from our hotspots now. Now what do we do with it? That we're part of the juvenile justice reform cities with the National League of Cities. I got together this past spring with mayors from around the country to compare best practices. You know, we're doing some of the right stuff. Other cities are doing some of the right stuff. And the goal is to put that together and find a solution for this.
And your message to Minneapolitans who might be saying it's not as safe a city as it used to be, especially in these neighborhoods where this has happened, what's your message to them?
I would say Minneapolis is a safe city. I would say it is not, you know, that this summer, you know, there are some areas of crime that were actually down. We are seeing an uptick this year. Of course, that concern people find that concerning. That includes me, and we're doing what we can. But that overall, Minneapolis remains a very safe city.
Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Tom Cran talked with the mayor last night on All Things Considered. Two brothers from the suburbs of Minneapolis are wrestling with a weighty question. How do you build confidence in American Muslim kids so they can be proud of both their country and their faith? Their answer is children's books. Amin and Mohammed Asser have launched 8 picture books and have plans to scale up the family business. Laura Ewan has the story.
Amin Asser didn't need to look further than his own childhood to inspire his book series. It's set in a town called Maple Grove, which is where he grew up, and it follows a story of 4 cartoon animals, including one who bears his name.
Amin is sort of the sports star. Yeah, he's named after me. a little bit shameless.
And he's a panda?
He's a panda. Charismatic. He's got a great smile, just like me. No, I'm kidding.
The real Amin Asser is 27, bearded, wide-eyed, and yes, he's got a great smile. He's sitting at the kitchen table in the house he grew up in. Beside him is his older brother, Mohammed Asser, now 30, who is a little burlier with glasses. The series is called Noor Kids. That's N-O-O-R. And in Arabic, it means the light, as if to illuminate the way for little Muslims. The brothers both have impressive business school pedigrees. Mohammed graduated from Harvard, and Amin is pursuing his MBA at University of California, Berkeley, after he worked on the corporate side of Target and General Mills. So why are these guys creating kids' books? Amin Asser says the idea started in this very room.
We were sitting around this table, and my sister, she's the oldest, she said she was having a baby. And the three of us began reflecting on our own childhood, about what it was like to grow up as a Muslim in North America. And that's when sort of the light bulb went off. We said, there's no way we want Asia, my sister's daughter, to experience the same challenges that we did.
Those challenges of growing up Muslim and as the children of Pakistani-born parents are not hard for these brothers to recall. They include a painful backlash following the September 11th terrorist attacks. At the time, Mohammed Asser was a 16-year-old kid working at a computer store.
I still remember there was a lady who came in and she said, I can't believe you guys have someone named Mohammed working here, and went to like the manager at the front of the store and said that, and said, I'm never going to shop here again.
And Amin was just 13 when the plane struck the World Trade Center. He remembers a friend turning on him and bullying him online. And while Amin's mother loved to root for her youngest child at Little League games, he'd beg her to pick him up well after the games ended so the other kids wouldn't see that she wore a headscarf. Looking back, he realizes he was ashamed of his identity.
It wasn't how other people thought about Muslims. It was how I, as a Muslim, thought about myself.
It's a struggle his brother Mohammed can relate to.
And so this dichotomy forms in your mind, potentially, and that is, can I be a great American, and can I be a great Muslim?
That's why the brothers decided to launch Noor Kids. They wanted to reclaim the story of American Muslims and the values the religion teaches. But the most basic desire was to offer something they rarely experienced as children, getting young Muslims to see themselves in the books they read. And as for the Islamic kids' books they did read growing up, Mohammed Asser says they were often didactic.
They talk about the what of prayer, like this is how you pray,
yeah.
This is how you fast, this is how you do X, Y, Z. And quite frankly, the what, while it's relevant, is not important. The why is the important part. The why of why do we do what we do? What is it that fasting at the end of the day gets us? The patience. It allows people of all different socioeconomic backgrounds to feel what it means to be hungry.
The Noor Kids books are simple stories that explore issues like bullying, charity, and jealousy. The books are intended for 4 to 8-year-olds. Since the Osler's published their first book 4 years ago, they've sold copies to 25,000 households all over the world. In the same period, they've seen Islamic children's literature in the West take off. One thing that their series doesn't address is the issue of violent extremism in their own community. Amin Asser says when they started the series, the books weren't made to save their young readers from that. They were made to save them from losing their identity.
Fast forward, you know, where we are today, could this also help children understand what their beliefs actually are so that way they can stand up against violent extremism? Yeah. If a child understands what their beliefs are, what are the roots of their religion? It'll bear good fruit.
The Asser brothers say their vision for reaching little Muslims go far beyond books. This year, they launched an online summer camp and have plans to get into animation and mobile apps. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Maple Grove.
Finally, on today's beautiful world, a cyclist goes global.
This is a beautiful world.
I'm Heather McElhattan, and this is a beautiful world.
Cycling through different cultures and different countries and not going back to your own bed every night. As I say, it hasn't really sunk in yet, the places I've been to, but it will.
Tom Davis is 19 years old. He lives in London, and he just finished school last summer. And he wanted to do something different for his gap year. So, since he was an enthusiastic cyclist, he decided to bicycle around the world.
My family were incredibly supportive. I think my mom probably thought I was joking. I don't know if she was actually very happy about it at the time, but they never said anything to me. They were just, 100% behind me.
When Davis completes his journey, he'll become the youngest person to ever circumnavigate the globe.
As far as I know, I'm the youngest.
At least he thinks he is. The Guinness Book of World Records stopped recording the youngest person achievements due to safety concerns, but Davis is still using their criteria for his journey. He has to use the same bike for the entire trip. No drafting. He has to start and finish at the same point. And he has to pass through two approximate antipodal points, which are opposite points on the Earth, like Wellington, New Zealand, and just north of Madrid, Spain, which are both on Davis's route. And the total distance he travels must exceed the length of the equator.
I don't know, my favorite road that I've ridden on was the Great Ocean Road, which is south coast of Australia, just before Melbourne. That was beautiful, you know, riding along the coast.
Davis hopes to complete his trip in 200 days, about 7 months, which means he has to cycle about 100 miles a day, with the odd day off for a bit of R&R. And on his journey, he's keeping a detailed blog with interactive maps and photographs of the scenes and souls he meets along his route, which sounds as exotic as it does exhausting.
So the first leg was London to Istanbul, and I went down the west coast and up the east coast of India. And then I flew to Myanmar, and I went down to Singapore. And I did all of the south coast of Australia in New Zealand and flew from there to San Francisco. Eventually, I'm flying out of Boston to Lisbon. And then the final bit is from there up through Portugal, Spain, France to London again.
Not only will Davis be the youngest person to circumnavigate the globe, he's doing it for charity. Three charities.
One is called Sahana Research Fund. It focuses on researching for a really nasty skin condition. The second one is prostate cancer. And the third one helps underprivileged young people.
Davis has raised almost $80,000 for these charities, which is considerable since he's not big on self-promotion and he hasn't gotten much press. He's worked for every penny on this grueling journey, battling with equipment breakdowns, physical injuries, pedaling alongside vast oceans and sparse deserts, maneuvering through roaring traffic, shouting children, lumbering elephants, all the while making observations online that range from wise to comical. Like, the Greeks put too many onions in their salad, and nobody knows the plural word for moose in Canada. And the worst thing about Australia is that the men wear Uggs. His biggest observation, however, caught him off guard.
I guess I didn't really expect people are really friendly throughout the whole world that I've been to. Yeah, they will go so far out of their way to help you. So that's been really, really nice to experience. It really is incredible.
Davis plans to finish his journey on the 9th of August. That's when he'll return back home to London, having pedaled over 18,000 miles all around the world.
My idea of the beautiful world is somewhere where everything's really relaxed and just a general kind of laid-back attitude, I guess. I think taking yourself too seriously is the wrong way to go about life.
I'm Heather McElhattan, and this is A Beautiful World.
You can hear more stories from A Beautiful World at npr.org/abeautifulworld. And that's the NPR News Update for a Tuesday. I'm Phil Picardi, just tickled pink to bring it to you. Join me tomorrow for the Wednesday Minnesota News.